Genesis chapters 39 and 40. The theme, alas, in this day, the theme is that same one as last Sunday morning, of unsavory sexuality, but by contrast here with last Sunday morning, with the very opposite effect of that of Judah, which of course is more than a relief to us from the sordidness of Judah's acquired pagan relations that we read of in Genesis chapter 38, and from Judah himself, as he was as a youngster. Talk about a prodigal. Judah, destined to be the leader of that people that would come to David and Jesus. But what a sinner in his youth. Joseph is the very opposite of his uncle Judah, apart from his youthful sin, of course. You remember of flaunting the favor that was laid upon him by his father and by God indeed when God gave him those wonderful dreams. We suppose that the lad Joseph was radically altered from the time, you remember, of his brother's assault on him, when they sold him to Egypt as a slave. That would have taken the pride out of him, wouldn't it? Although by the mercy of God, and indeed by Uncle Judah's mercy too, as you remember, Joseph fared better than he might have done, or as some punitive persons might have thought the youngster deserved for his pride and arrogance. The change, I suppose, would have begun suddenly when he found himself stripped of his grand coat and cast into the pit and wondering what in the world would happen to him next, and then sold as a slave to be carried to Egypt, where a Hebrew slave might not have been thought of much account. Although, at the same time, we must admit that when we consider how lavishly an earlier Pharaoh's officials had dealt with Abraham when he landed in Egypt, when he strayed into Egypt, you remember they recommended the beautiful Sarah, Abraham's wife, to Pharaoh. Here again, Joseph, for all his plight of being cruelly wrenched from his father Jacob's favor and landed as a slave in Egypt, Joseph is fortunate in that he is bought by a man of consequence in Egypt and not by any taskmaster, as the Egyptians later became, you know, to Israel. And Joseph was, of course, an excellent fellow. And by now, all the superficial, youthful arrogance having been drained away from him by his affliction, when he presented himself to Potiphar, he would have seemed to that good man, in the modern parlance, looking for slaves or servants, he would have seemed to him a good buy. And Joseph proved to be that and more. And there's a wonderful lesson here for us, you know, right away, that for all the afflictions of the Lord's chosen ones, all that the Lord's chosen ones may suffer, there is always a providence with them. God had chosen this stripling for his divine favor, and despite the afflictions which his father's folly and his own naivety brought upon him, he was still in the line of the Lord's blessing. And so he prospered and was given a place in that household which would only have been accorded to one who was quickly seen to be reliable and trustworthy. His master Potiphar saw, if you please, that the Lord, Yahweh, Jehovah, the God of the Jews, was with him, and that it was he, the Lord, who made Joseph successful in all that he did. So that, naturally, Potiphar favored the young man more and more and put him in charge of all his household, until the prosperity of Potiphar's household became so notable that he himself, who left everything to the young man, knew whence this blessing to his household came. He knew that it came from this young man's God, Yahweh, Jehovah, the God of the Jews. And that was a wonderful testimony. And this, to my mind, is the perfect example of what I like to call primary evangelism. And by that I mean that of witnessing naturally and winsomely where one is set, living the life before men at whatever cost and whatever one is called to do, without turning a hair to become a self-conscious evangelist, as with fasting. So in evangelical witness, I believe, unconscious influence is always best. Why? Because it obviates the temptation to pride. And one of the subtlest dangers of Christians and Christian workers is the danger to pride in their very service of the Lord. Is that not so? But the trouble was, God had given to Joseph so many gifts of faith that led to character, but also had given him good looks and manly physique, that became an attraction to his lustful mistress. In essence, you know, this temptation to Joseph is a kind of microcosm of what the devil always wants to do when he sees a beautiful Christian. You know what he wants to do when someone shines for Christ. He wants to spoil him or her. Satan hated the blamelessness of Joseph and his prosperity. But while he must also have hated his good looks, he saw, did the devil, that he could use that, and he did, to fire the lasciviousness of Potiphar's unfaithful spouse. God used God's gift to him for ill. Those who have such gifts from the Lord, you know, while being thankful for them, gifts that make life successful and popular, need very much to beware Satan's use of our natural advantages, God-given as they are, or maybe. Woe to believers who, having been endowed with natural blessings, have not by affliction or by embracing willingly the cross of Jesus Christ, have developed that character and have gained those moral standards that will enable them to ward off Satan's attempts to spoil a beautiful life. Such a believer is exceedingly vulnerable. We are most vulnerable and in greatest danger when we are being blessed. Is that not so? But not so Joseph. And see how he argues. See how he argues the very opposite of that which a weaker soul would have done in his plight. He said, because my master has left me in charge of all his household and does not concern himself about it and has withheld nothing from me but his wife, I must respect that prohibition particularly. And you see, of course, that's exactly like the original prohibition of the tree in the midst of the Garden of Eden, isn't it? Only there, Eve was susceptible to the satanic and serpentine whisper. You remember what the serpent whispered to her when she answered him? He said, "Hath God said?" and questioned the truth of God's word. You see, lesser souls are souls susceptible to satanic suggestion, like Eve and Adam, would have said something like this, that since the master had left so much in their care, it would not be all that greater a sin to overstep the boundary set for once and indulge in a little illicit and flattering pleasure. Mind you, I could believe that such an excellent young man as Joseph might also have said to himself. Do you think he might have said something like this? Who does she think she is that I would want to find pleasure with stolen goods, another man's wife, as if she was the last woman on the horizon? But you see, if that thought or anything like it had occurred to him, that's certainly not the argument he presented to her. Here was a man who had his morals right. Long before the explicit Ten Commandments were formulated for Israel, the essence of Genesis chapter 2, verse 24, had entered into his soul, that a man would leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they two would be one flesh. That, the essence of that, had obviously entered into Joseph's soul, just as Jesus, you remember, of whom some think Joseph is the very best type in the Old Testament, Jesus interpreted that verse in Genesis 2:24. Thus, you remember what Jesus said? Haven't you read that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female and said, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate, let not man put asunder. If two became one flesh, to disrupt that unified relationship was a sin, not only against the person, but against the God who had ordained marriage as thus being sacred. But it was not merely a sudden one-off temptation that Joseph had to contend with, as you see from the record. That woman certainly lusted after the young man, who was perhaps too much with her in the house for her good. And so she persisted day by day, which must have been a tremendous test of Joseph's integrity. Ah, but since his integrity was not only moral, but religious, and had that deeper foundation, it would hold. Do you see that? Morality without religion, ethical standards without God, do not have sufficient ground to pin down our susceptible natures and to foil Satan's wiles to save us from deviations. Without a rock on which to build, morality, however strong its individual rules may be about this and that, morality will not stand the storms which Jesus speaks about, you remember, in the parable. The house may not be built on pure sand. Not many would be so foolish. But it may be built up, a mason-built foundation of stones, even thoroughly cemented together and built into the sand. But even that will be shifted by a sufficient hurricane, whereas a house, say, built nearby on solid, living, primeval rock will withstand any storm short of an earthquake. Now, when you think of this and apply it to the present day and our situation, you see what has happened. We'll just wait a moment. There are those there that will attend to our dear sister who are trained in that. Yes, let me go back a little bit. Let us concentrate our minds on what I was saying. The difference between building on sand, even building a fairly solid house upon sand, I'm saying, and building upon solid living rock. And I was going on to say, you see what has happened in our country and over the whole of professedly Christian West. Our religious life, apart from minorities, tiny minorities, our religious life has long since been undermined and is now utterly despised by the generality of the population. Do you doubt that? They'll say they believe in God, but what does that matter? At 10:45 on a Sunday morning in Union Street when I was a boy, the pavements were literally crowded. It was on a Saturday morning or afternoon, crowded with worshippers going to church. And indeed, if someone appeared in Union Street then in casual dress, say out with a dog, they would have been looked at askance. Now it is no longer religion that is assailed. Religion for most people has gone. I have watched for over 4 decades where I live as people have moved out and then moved in. I must be one of the longest living in my street, in my area. And I've watched as people have moved out and in, and it is hard to find anyone coming in to the area who is even church attending. And I watch carefully. Sunday with us in the West End, so-called West End, Sunday is the day for queues at the paper shop and for washing on the line or cleaning the car or whirring electric mowers in the garden. And as a legacy from a generation or two of that, now, what have we? Not only this abuse of children that we are sick hearing about so much, broken homes, broken hearts, broken children, needing psychiatric help, and more than psychiatric help if they knew it. And our so-called intellectuals who dominate Parliament and the media are as blind as bats to see the vital relationship between true religion and morals. They refuse it. But there it is. The connection is close, couldn't be closer, between true religion and morals. You see, it was not merely Joseph's morals that kept him from the woman, but his fear of God. It was his religion. How could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? Good Joseph, call it by its proper name, it's sin. How could I sin against God? And he kept saying this until one day she became completely frustrated. And what she thought was love for the young man turned, as it does, when it is lust and not love, it turned to hate. And she stormed out on his latest refusal to accuse him of the very thing he refused to do. The perversity, do we begin to realize the perversity of the devil? I wonder if we do. How sheerly perverse he is. He'll stop at nothing. So she screamed the house down, and when her astonished husband came in and saw his wife blazing contempt for the young man he had trusted so much, being completely deceived by his wife, he burned with anger too and clapped the poor fellow in prison. The special prison, notice. Ah, God's providence, not the ordinary prison. Clapped him in the special prison reserved for royal prisoners. It's interesting that the word in Genesis is a special word, not the ordinary word for prison. But what a blow to Joseph for doing right. But did it make him bitter? No. He, poor chap, had been through similar humiliation before. Perhaps he knew that being put in that particular prison was a providence of God. So far from being bitter, the Lord gave Joseph grace to behave so wisely that the warder trusted him and put him in charge, apparently, of everything, which is quite astonishing. The second time this had happened to the man. Quite astonishing. And I think can only be explained by the fact that the Lord was with Joseph, prospering him in all that he did, even in resisting that woman and landing in jail. But a particular jail. So here's the second lesson. Not only does true religion breed a steadfast, rock-like morality that refuses to be shaken even by the most sustained attacks and temptations, but it draws the favor of God, the grace of God, which is a general thing, pervades the whole of one's life, and in time produces a prosperity which is obvious to all, and which inspires, not jealousy in those around, but inspires respectful admiration and an attitude of trust which soon loads the favored one, such as Joseph, with high privileges and honors. First Potiphar saw the stamp of the man because of his religion and his morals flowing from his religion. Then the warder in the prison saw the stamp of the man flowing from his morals, flowing from his religion. You see that? Isn't that wonderful? And Joseph's privileges increased, for as we read, two royal servants were thrown into prison, and he had charge of them. And one night both of these men had a dream, and Joseph, the observant, caring one, noticed that the men were dejected, and kindly asked the cause. That's a word to us too. Do we have such sensitivity to other people's distress or perplexity that we notice? So they each told Joseph their dream. The chief cupbearer's dream was perhaps not all that hard for Joseph to interpret. With the aid of the Lord, of course, it almost contained its own message. But the man wouldn't see that, would he? Although Joseph did. In 3 days he would be released and be restored to his former onerous duties of testing the king's wine before he drank it. So, of course, here was Joseph's opportunity to ask a favor of the cupbearer for what he had done for him. Mention me to Pharaoh, since I was carried off as a Hebrew slave, and I've done nothing wrong. Indeed, have done what is right by my master, and then to be cast into prison for doing what is right. But note, the cupbearer is not recorded as promising anything, which may or may not be significant. I don't know. As we know, when all was well with the cupbearer and he was restored, he forgot Joseph and his plight, which is a typical worldly attitude, isn't it? I'm all right, Jack. But the chief baker also had a dream which he told Joseph. And it says much, don't you think? It says much for the integrity of this young man, Joseph, that understanding the baker's dream. You know, the birds of the air, even that early in Scripture, suggest a sinister image to the godly. And Jesus used that image of the birds in the air in his parable, you remember. But Joseph, understanding the baker's dream, faithfully declared to the baker what he saw. Nor did he mince his words, our kindly young Joseph. So like our Lord, as gentle and tender and considerate and kind, more than any man could ever be, and yet so straight and true, and his words cut with rapier thrust into the consciences of the wicked. Pharaoh was to lift off the poor man's head. And so it took place on a day of celebration of Pharaoh's birthday, if you please. Honor for the cupbearer, and violent death, apparently, for the baker. And one wonders, although they both offended Pharaoh, one wonders for what? One wonders whether both of these results were deserved. Whether the one was a good man and the other bad. We don't know. It doesn't say, and is apparently not material to the story. Although as moralists, as Christian moralists, we would have liked to know what justification there was for restoring the cupbearer and executing the baker, wouldn't we? However, 2 full years after that, Joseph waited, doubtless, each day, hoping he would hear the result of the cupbearer's approach to Pharaoh. Waiting and waiting and waiting over 2 long years, but nothing. And it reminds us, hasn't this occurred to you, those of you who have been following our studies in the Acts of the Apostles? It reminds us of Paul's 2 full years languishing in that Caesarean prison. And then, another dream. To Pharaoh himself this time. So much so that we are inclined to say, oh God, you are an expert purveyor of dreams. You deal very much, or did in those ancient days, very much in dreams. When you want to do something special, you give a dream. And we would ask the prophet Daniel if that was so? And he says, yes, I think so. I think so. Dream after dream after dream. And this one was special. Wasn't it, Pharaoh? Did you realize at first, Pharaoh, that it is not you wouldn't have known that this dream was not unrelated to the dreams of him who was languishing in your jail. But, Pharaoh, you'll need some help with this one. But there, alas, we must leave our cereal for today to whet our appetite for the next installment. But we've plenty, haven't we, in these two chapters to browse upon now? And the great thing here, you might think, is the sterling character of Joseph. And one could tell the story from that point of view. And of course that's true. But you see, it is all part of a larger whole, which is what God is doing in and around Joseph. It's the larger whole that we are concerned with in these studies. The Lord lands Joseph in a special prison for his morality. And then these men join him there. And then they need him because of their dreams. Because Joseph knows a little about dreams, even a modicum about dreams beginning to come true. And in this case also he's proved right in his interpretation. And all that he asks of the cupbearer, the survivor of the two royal servants, that he will tell Pharaoh about him and being wrongfully imprisoned in his special prison. But the man forgets. And notice God allows him to forget for 2 years, because the Lord is not short of stratagems. He'll give Pharaoh a dream, but he'll wait 2 years for it, and then he'll give Pharaoh a dream. And that's a thought, isn't it? It's great to belong to a God who has direct access to a Pharaoh and can give him a dream in the night when he wants. Even of the Pharaoh who happens to concern us in our day is not called Pharaoh, but say he might be called Matsitung, or Gorbachev, or Gaddafi, or Khomeini, or Reagan, or Thatcher. So Pharaoh gets his rather important and ominous dream and needs an interpreter. And of course it's this that jogs his memory. But that's going too fast. Pleasures to come. But you see who's in charge. Don't you think we should trust such an ingenious workman as our God is? Trust him utterly? He's never stuck for a stratagem or a tactic. But you see, we've only one difficulty there, and that is God's will. That's the hurdle. For if we know his will and believe it as he reveals it to us, then we know that nothing in the world can stop him fulfilling it. In his own time, of course. But it's to know the will of God. So as I was saying last Sunday evening, quoting Ter Stegen's beautiful hymn, you remember, "Thou sweet beloved will of God," which Ter Stegen later on in the hymn calls, you remember, his wonderful grand will. To know the will of God in order to do it is everything. Everything. Oh, I would say that more and more each day that I live and stand on this box. To know that God put me here is everything. And to know God's will for our lives, however long we wait for Him to reveal it, is practically everything. Because, you see, that can harness all the power in the universe, all the power that there is in the universe. It can harness it. And His will shall be done. No one, even the master of evil himself, can hinder God fulfilling His will, however unlikely it may seem at any particular point that it could be done. So may I, as I draw to a close, may I tell you a story about Ter Stegen's hymn. I read the whole of that hymn from the Redemption Songbook at the close of the sermon last Sunday evening. Those of you who were here would remember. Beautiful hymn. And on Monday morning, dear bereaved John Kelly from Bangor was on the phone to tell me how he was after his young wife Barbara suddenly passed away on Saturday evening. Poor John didn't sleep that night. Who would? And words came to him of this hymn. I had forgotten that I had read every word of that hymn in addressing John and Barbara at their wedding, which I conducted in Belfast nearly 10 years ago. And John got up from his sleepless couch to refresh his memory of this hymn. And the dear man was comforted. And when he knew, as I told him on the telephone, that we had read it all on Sunday evening, he was comforted the more and was sure that the Lord was directing its sweet and consoling truth to him as well as to us. And it did console us. I can tell you that the reading of that hymn did console here last Oliver and Helen Klassen, who came to us from Australia en route to the United States for furlough after service of church planting in Australia. Oliver and Helen Klassen, who may come to a crossroads in their life within the next few months, were comforted by that word too. And a gentleman farmer and his wife, who spent the weekend with us last weekend from Lothian, came to say on Sunday evening that the day's ministry had been especially helpful to them, for they were at a crossroads in their lives and had wanted a word of reassurance and had got it. You know, I sometimes think when the servants of God come from other spheres to challenge us about being up and doing, you know, people who have been abroad in Christian service sometimes think that nobody does anything at home, that you only serve abroad, which surely is a very great mistake, but one senses this from time to time. When people come and challenge us to be up and doing, or when people come amongst us and see us all sitting so douce and sedate, and maybe seemingly so pleased with ourselves, that they want to shake us all up. But they may not know what is going on constantly by the operation of the Word of God on minds and hearts and consciences and wills. You see, years ago, when David Torrance, the youngest of these three illustrious brothers, when David Torrance came to Aberdeen to minister in Summer Hill, he said to me one day, "What have you done, Mr. Still, all these years you have been in Aberdeen?" I think he meant that I had hardly got the presbytery aflame, and that's true, although there are far more conservative men ministering in Aberdeen now than there were then. All I could say to David was that if he wanted to see what the Lord had done here, he would need to read our history or go abroad. For the most of the fruit, not all of it, thank God, but the most of the fruit scatters from here. And often you can scarcely see our erstwhile associations for dust as they go to the ends of the earth. Although, of course, we still hold on to them by our prayers. Even if we never hear of them for 10 or 20, 30, 40 years, we still remember them in prayer. God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. Did you hear the sun rise early this morning? Or have I in 43 years heard that tree in my neighbor's garden, which must be one of the biggest trees in the whole city? Have I heard that tree growing? A tree which was quite a tree 80 years ago when Walker Leith looked over to it from Deswood Place. Have I heard it grow to such a tremendous spread? The Daimler car used to pride itself on the silence of its engine, but it sure went and was full of power. You see what I'm saying? The Lord. And we may be touching on this again this evening. The Lord does not need noise to work. And he's never in a hurry. Joseph, languishing in prison, like Paul much later, for 2 whole years, Waiting each day, poor man, for the footfall of the warder to open the door and let him out. Ah, the cupbearer may forget, but God doesn't. He's always, can I use this expression, he's always another trick. Or is it a dream up his sleeve? And he won't be late either. So we need, above all things, to trust him. To trust him and his sweet, grand will. He cannot fail those who put their trust in him. And it is our prayer, it is our earnest, anguished prayer, isn't it, these days, that many, many stricken souls across our city and land and far beyond may be moved by his Spirit and by the ministrations of those who know the Lord to put their trust in him and prove, however long it takes, and it could take long with some, that his will is always good. We're going to sing about that will now. A hymn by Charlotte Elliott, 539. My God and Father, while I stray far from my home in life's rough way, oh, teach me from my heart to say thy will be done.